Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about the founding of the BBC under the auspices of its first Director General, Lord John Rees. In the years just after the First World War, the government saw radio with immense suspicion. This is the British government, obviously. They thought that any means of mass transmission of ideas to the public was something that needed to be treated extremely carefully in an age of the development of mass ideologies and serious threats on the right and the left to the continuance of liberal capitalist democracy. There was, in the eyes of the government, a lot to be worried about. As it transpires, most threats to the liberal order in Great Britain between the wars were, you know, pretty much phantoms compared to events on the continent. But that doesn't prevent politicians at the time from having heightened senses of anxiety. A couple of weeks ago, I did a podcast on labour unrest. In the 1920s, in the immediate aftermath of the war. So you might want to listen to that. It'll give you kind of some wider context about what I'm going to talk about going forward. In 1922, the British Broadcasting Company was established. Guglielmo Marconi, who had pioneered radio technology, found that the government was incredibly obstructive, but they relent by 1922, but only because it is licensed by the government. It becomes, right from the get-go, an organisation that has a close and complicated relationship with the state. There's perhaps not enough scope right now to talk about the entire complexity of the history of the BBC. But one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about it and its origins today is because as a national broadcaster, I don't think it's appropriate to call it a state broadcaster because it's not really directed by the state. The licence fee is a statutory obligation that all payers have, that all listeners and viewers have in the UK to pay, but it's not a state broadcaster in as much as it's not meant to, at least, parrot the views of the state. In recent decades, there's been considerable argument, and fairly justifiable argument, is that that's what it now tends to do, but that's the scope of a media studies debate, and we'll maybe tackle that one another time. The impact in the from 1922 onwards that the government has on the BBC is pronounced, but also subtle as well. The BBC have, shall we say, certain institutional biases, but the commitment of the BBC is ostensibly to remain impartial. The close relationship meant that radio programmes reflected the values of the government and the BBC, not necessarily in the interests of the listener. As a result, BBC broadcasts often didn't reflect the quality of life experienced by many people in the 20s and 30s. Instead, it reflected the values that middle-class British people and the British establishment had, and made broad assumptions about what it is working-class people listened to, enjoyed and understood. In 1927, the BBC is given a royal charter and it becomes the British Broadcasting Corporation, becomes publicly owned, and the independence, in the BBC charter, editorial independence is granted, and John Reith then became the first Director General. Reith's mission that he set out in the 1920s was that the BBC ought to do three things: inform, educate and entertain. The entertain bit was the most disliked of Reith's objectives. And in the 20s and 30s, the BBC broadcast lectures, concerts and programmes that Reith thought would be beneficial to ordinary people. So Reith had a real patrician attitude towards working-class British people. And he thought that their understanding of the world could be improved through the BBC. And no doubt it probably was. Reith claimed that the BBC should give the public slightly better than it thinks it wants. And this, after the war in the 1960s, with the advent of ITV, and later in the 60s and early 70s with the advent of the kind of the tabloid newspaper reporting we now know with Rupert Murdoch and The Sun. This was a direct attack that these institutions had on the BBC, the idea that this was a kind of a liberal elitism talking down to the ordinary man and telling the ordinary man what it is that he really should be enjoying instead of serving up what the ordinary man in the ideas of people like Rupert Murdoch should actually want or actually wanted. Both paradigms, you could say, are equally patronising and simply aiming for the lowest common denominator in the assumption that this is what you know, the lower orders are entertained by. Again, is probably as offensive, if not slightly more so. Reith himself is remembered by those who work with him as something of an authoritarian tyrant and an elitist, somebody who quite possibly would have fitted in with certain of the more rabid parts of Fleet Street today. Now, for my money, one of the best books that you can have on your shelf on the subject of media history in the UK is Power Without Responsibility by Seaton and Curran, Gene Seaton and James Curran, Gene Seaton being the kind of the official historian of the BBC right now. And the reason why this is such a good book is it combines a number of different disciplines, a real detailed understanding of media history, and also a number of different sociological and critical theory approaches to understanding the media. It's pretty much like the standard text for media studies courses, but and there's about 9 editions of it, because obviously the media doesn't stop changing, but well worth owning a copy. The model for the BBC that kind of predates the BBC is the post office, an example of essentially a nationally run business. That William Beveridge of the Beveridge Report fame said in 1905 that the GPO was the one socialist experiment that now works well. Other aspects of national life that were public corporations set up before the BBC were forestry, the water supply system, and electricity. These are all sort of, in essence, nationalisations before the concept existed. The First World War had been one of the really important periods that had created a broad consensus across the nation for what's known as public service utility. What this means is that if you look at AJP Taylor's history of Britain 1914 to 1939, he makes the point that in 1914, he refers to Englishmen, but he really means British people, they were some of the most unregulated, lowest taxed people in the world whose relationship with the state was fairly minimal. Britain was a country founded on notions of 19th century liberalism, that the state has a limited amount to do in the lives and the businesses of anybody. And not only was this a guarantor of some kind of notion of freedom, one that is far more readily embraced now in the USA, but also it meant that taxes would be low. Well, the First World War destroys all that. I mean, the First World War under the Defence of the Realm Act says essentially the state has a competence wherever it sees fit for the duration of the war. And actually, state-run enterprises during the war do extremely well. The reorganisation of war industries under David Lloyd George as Minister for Munitions is a sight to behold, and it's that that is a considerable factor in winning the war for Britain. And at the end of the war, the state, the case for state intervention and state management has been roundly made. And then during the 1920s and 30s, again, the idea that things can be simply left to market provision in times of almost an ending economic crisis seems to be irrational and backward. So there was always opposition to the centralisation of health insurance, coal and the railways, and indeed rationing of food. But by the 1920s, the generation of reformers who'd lived through the war and had been civil servants during that time were experienced in organising and the centralised distribution of resources, and they were able to make the case for all manner of public utilities, broadcasting being one of them. The development of public corporations meant that market forces had to be rejected, and in their place was the idea that efficiency and planning and control by experts, and for that matter, elite experts, was really the medicine that would make something like the BBC work. So the BBC was never going to become, given the intellectual and economic and social climate of the times, a free market enterprise. And there was as much a fear of transmitting Bolshevik ideas as much as that was a fear, I think there was a fear of transmitting the kind of raucous, brash.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Aggressive and hyper-sexualized American culture of enterprise. Bear in mind, at this point in time, America, during the First World War, has finally eclipsed Great Britain. The year 1916 sees the end, really, of British economic hegemony and the rise of American. And along with that, the rise of an American cultural hegemony. Reith was very keen to make sure that things like jazz and American music was kept out of the acceptable range of music to be broadcast on BBC radio. In return for its monopoly status, the BBC was also able to render service to the government in times of crisis, for example during the 1926 general strike, which we'll look at in just a moment. Impartiality, the first great test of impartiality for the BBC came during the general strike, and Rees knew that the survival of the BBC would depend very much on how that notion of impartiality was navigated during the strike. One of the things that the strike does, because it's a national strike, is it creates a national audience for broadcast news. For the first time, people look more to the radio than they do to newspapers to find out what's going on. Beatrice Webb, whom I speak about periodically, the social reformer and social researcher, said in her diary that the sensation of the general strike centres around the headphones of the wireless set. There were, at the time, 2 million wireless licence holders, and that represented a far greater number of listeners. And there was obviously, for every licence holder, there is communal listening. The wireless was a centrepiece in the living room, and it was how the family interacted, much as we, in the post-war era, we became... people in Great Britain, we're going around the world here, people in Great Britain became TV watchers, and have been described as a TV nation. Before the war, in the interwar era, we could be thought of as a wireless nation. The 2 million licence holders were a significant factor in the crisis of the general strike. And people were able to become far more involved and engaged, if not necessarily informed, with the strike through the medium of wireless. The ability of the BBC to transmit information that at first glance appeared to be ideologically neutral and yet still conveyed key messages from the government was a kind of a far more subtle and powerful innovation in state propaganda than had previously existed. The First World War, as Seaton and Curran point out, during the First World War, propaganda had portrayed all Germans as sort of baby butchering monsters. And it's the kind of overtop hyperbole that ultimately becomes unsuccessful. People stop believing it and listening to it. In order to underline that point, when Winston Churchill launched a propaganda newspaper, the British Gazette, daily news sheet that reported the kind of the evils of Bolshevism, basically one of Churchill's favourite talking points, it was seen as being so ludicrous and over the top that it was ignored. Churchill wanted to seize the BBC as a state and turn it into a state propagandist. Rees said that if the BBC came out in support of the miners or was seen as being sympathetic to the miners, that it would be simply shut down. And so Rees was fairly clear as to where power lay and what to do about this. It could be said that Rees was an enthusiastic supporter of the government, and his own particular biases and his own particular prejudices meant that this was always likely to be the case. Rees was cleverer than Churchill, though, and he cautioned Churchill and the government to let the BBC do its job. He said that, firstly, the crisis would be heightened if the BBC was suppressed or if the government was seen as trying to suppress information at all. And he said that the BBC needed to gain the trust of the strikers, the trust of the government, and the public at large. And the result of this would be that the BBC could be part of some kind of compromise, some kind of resolution. Not, you might argue, the BBC's role at all. He said, "In the end, conciliations of some kind must supervene, and the BBC could act as a link to draw together the contending parties by creating an atmosphere of goodwill towards its service on both sides." So by being a national institution, being recognised as a national institution, part of the national conversation, this would help to pour oil on troubled waters. Reith was not inclined, however, to help the government, to help the strikers force the government to capitulate, and he was not inclined to help find a compromise that really was too far in the favour of the workers. And he uses this term, it's a very interesting one. He says that trust gained by what he calls authentic, impartial news could then be used. It was not necessarily an end in itself. So what he's saying here, really, is that that which is presented in its authenticity, seemingly without bias, that can gain trust from the population, can then, to contradict Reith, be used for the political ends of the government. As if to underline his biases, he said, "Since the BBC was a national institution, and since the government in this crisis was acting for the people, the BBC was for the government in the crisis too." One historian, one biographer of Reith, Patrick Renshaw, has said that Reith would have supported the union against the pit owners, the National Union of Miners against the pit owners, but he was not prepared to support the TUC, the Trade Union Congress, against the government. And Martin Gilbert, the very famous biographer of Churchill, has made the same point, that Churchill would probably have looked to find some kind of compromise between the miners and the pit owners, but he was not interested in any kind of compromise with the TUC. It was in 1926 that the BBC has its news-gathering breakthrough. Prior to that, press barons such as Rothermere and Beaverbrook and the like had put pressure on the government to prevent the BBC from having any news-gathering role. The press had prohibited the BBC from collecting news, and the strike enabled the BBC to develop its own news service. The BBC, during the strike, reports the views of strikers and it reports the views of strike breakers, but no representatives of organised labour, the Labour Party, for example, or any trade unions, are allowed to be reported. Again, giving this very misleading picture of the strike, there is a clear difference between representing the views of an individual striker who is not speaking in any collective sense and banning the views of a representative of organised labour who is presenting a collective vision, a collective standpoint, which is obviously what a strike actually is. Reith believed simply that the organisers of labour were wrong, and didn't want the public to be exposed to these views. The strike leader, Willie Graham, wrote to Reith saying, "The government emphatically deny that they interfere with the BBC in any way. On the other hand, the company states that it was not a free agent. I'm sure that you will agree that it is impossible to make any sense of these two statements." The reputation that the BBC get in the 1920s with the working classes is not a positive one. The BBC learnt how to censor itself. The BBC, during the strike, really understand where the boundaries, the invisible parameters and boundaries of its power and its mandate actually lie. And the general strike is a great exercise for the BBC and for the government in the use and the perfection of state propaganda. Simply bludgeoning the audience will not work. It has to be based on trust, and it has to be traced based on the appearance of impartiality. Because the strike was condemned by the government as being politically motivated, political mischief, and because the BBC was being seen to be above politics and apolitical, the consequences were that the trade union movement was deeply harmed by the strike and seen as being partisan and divisive, whereas the BBC, throughout the interwar and then post-war years, was really able to polish its halo, was able to present itself as above politics and something, a far more national institution, as opposed to a governmental one. Now, to say that it is a national institution is pretty valid. I mean, it certainly is. But the reasons why, the political and ideological journey to becoming that national institution, a key part of that are the events of the general strike. I hope you find this useful. If you're doing British history, I think you might find this handy, particularly if you're talking about the general strike. If you can give us a review on iTunes, that would be grand, and 5 stars, ideally. Do remember to subscribe to this channel, and we'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thanks, bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.